Hello, and welcome back to ID the Future. We're here once again with Dr. David Berlinski, a senior fellow at Discovery Institute, who's written some very erudite defenses of Darwin's Doubt, Stephen Meyer's book about the Cambrian explosion that came out earlier in 2013. We're here to talk with Dr. Berlinski about his responses to critics, and we would like to hear some more on the topic of cladistics. So, Dr. Berlinski, let's just jump right into this. Let's get back a little bit to some of the specific arguments that Matsky made. He cites arthropods as a quote-unquote instructive example of how arthropods evolved, or how any group evolved, that cladistics works, in his opinion, if you look at that group. So would you say that arthropods are an example of the success of cladistics in bringing clarity to some evolutionary story, or do they show something else?
Well, yeah, a success, sure. Let's say it's a success. We know more about arthropods now than we did 10, 15 years ago. But if you look at the experts, Nick Matsky is not an arthropod, what they say, I'm almost quoting, is that what we've managed to do is change a kind of a nightmare of uncertainty and confusion to something that's just a little less uncertain and confused. Well, that's fine. That's fine. There is no problem about that. But let's not blow this out of all proportion. The experts in the field, the people who have their hands on these vile bugs, are just as confused as one suspects they would. And they have managed to penetrate their own confusion to a certain extent. That's fine. That's progress. But let's not make this a crucial issue. It's nothing of the sort.
The one thing that I think everybody agrees that cladistics can potentially help us answer, whether it's an important question, maybe it is that it predicts a particular branching order or sequence in which characters arose. And it can help us to explain that. However, that makes certain implications about the fossil record. As you said, if things branched in a certain order, then that predicts or leads us to expect that we will find fossils with certain traits appearing in a certain order. So what does cladistics imply about what we should find in the fossil record? And what happens when we don't find those and we're required to invoke what they call ghost lineages? What's that all about?
I think the second remark answers your first question. Certainly, I can't think of any reason to pursue cladistics if it's pursued without a regard for the fossil record. After all, the fossil record is a record of extinct organisms. It is there in the ground, the stacked dead. If we're pursuing cladistics in a perfect vacuum, one wonders how on earth, aside from internal consistency, any cladistic hypothesis could ever be confirmed. The great difficulty, as everyone knows, is that no matter which cladistic hypothesis is invoked, at some point the fossil record is either silent because we don't have the fossils, or contradictory. It indicates that the fossil didn't branch at that point, or that there are no precursors when there should have been precursors. And Steve Meyer's Darwin Doubt makes that very clear. No matter where we look in the Cambrian, attempting to find precursors, whether in the pre-Cambrian or the early part of the Cambrian, has been fruitless. We can't find them. Maybe we will, who knows. The point is that in order to rescue the cladistic method, one has to invoke ghost lineages. That is, places in the cladogram connected by a dotted line to whatever is substantive or substantial, which indicates here one should find an organism that one hasn't found. And the fact that the fossil record doesn't find those organisms is impertinently considered a defect in the fossil record and not a defect in the cladogram. I think, of course, we should be very suspicious of anything like a ghost lineage, that is, a hypothetical organism without any kind of physical evidence. It's inevitable in this kind of undertaking. It is inevitable. I recognize that. We can't say this is a gross mistake in reasoning. Of course not. I mean, if somebody is doing a cladogram and there is a kind of a nested hierarchy and it all points in one direction and there is no evidential basis, what can you do beyond saying this is where it should be? All right. But let's realize the limitations of the method. Let's understand clearly this is not evidentiary by its nature. This is hypothetical.
And as you said earlier, I mean, the fossil record, that's the record. If there is evidence to be found, that's where we're going to find it. And you would like to hope that if your theory predicts some branching order, that when you go to look at the actual evidence, you're going to find some evidence there. You're going to find some support for that theory. And when you don't, you can't just say, oh, well, therefore the evidence just must be wrong. The record isn't complete. That's a very convenient way.
It is a very convenient way, and it's very difficult for people working in a field like cladistics or a field like paleontology to say, look, the decisive piece of evidence has got to be X or it's got to be Y. Yeah. That speaks to a kind of arrogance from which paleontologists, of course, recoil, because it doesn't sound right to say, look, we have primacy of place in this scheme of things. We're the guys you got to come to confirm your theory. Nobody wants to say quite that. What one hopes is there's going to be a splendid marriage between cladistics and paleontology in which both will support one another.
Sure.
That's never happened.
Yeah, exactly. So let's change topics just a little bit here. You wrote a few different responses defending some of Steve's arguments. And in one case...
Excuse me, more attacking Nick Matzke.
That's probably true. Okay, yeah. Fair enough. So Matzke obviously cited some papers which purport to explain the evolution of various genes and how various genes that we see in animals arose. You had some responses to these supposed stories and accounts of the evolution of genes. So what did you think of these examples and these stories of how genes arose? Did you find them persuasive? Why or why not? I mean, what do you feel about this body of literature that's developing that Matzke cited about how genes evolve?
Well, I think it's fine. It's just fine. But that's not the real question. The real question in context, which Matzke did not attend to, is not how this gene or that gene arose. Let's say that issue is settled. But the question is the one that Steve Meyer asked in Darwin's Doubt. How do we account for the origin of novel protein folds, major domains of protein folds, the way proteins are arranged, and the extreme difficulty of imagining how one protein fold or family of protein folds is by a process akin to alchemy transmuted into another? And so it's very much the same kind of problem. How do you transform a base metal into gold? How do you transform one protein domain with particular folds into another? Chemically, it's very hard. Not impossible, but then again, it's not impossible to transform a base metal into gold either. It can be done, just costs a lot of money, more than the gold is worth. The gene is only relevant to this discussion if it is a gene indicating how a novel protein fold is organized and achieved. But in every example that Matzke cites, and they're the canonical examples from literature, the genes don't do much of anything of interest. That's the trouble. There are slight variations. One is terrific for drunks. It breaks down certain kinds of alcohols. The other one is simply a very boring, repetitive pattern found in certain fish that live in ice. A third one does something else. But none of them offer an insight into the key questions. How do these novel protein folds emerge? That's what I objected to in Matzke's paper. And of course, Matzke knows that perfectly well. It's not news to him either.
That's a very important insight, that the examples that are cited for how genes evolved are not showing new protein folds. I remember one example that Steve Meyer mentioned in Darwin's Doubt about...
Lysase oxidase.
Oh, yeah. That was one that builds... It helps in arthropods, at least, to build...
Shelly crustaceans.
Yeah, it has other... Yeah, exactly. I don't know if they've actually tried to explain the origin of that gene. The one that I was thinking about, it's called RNase... 1 and RNase 1B.
Yeah.
And it deals with, I think, breaking down leaves in the stomach of certain types of monkeys. And one version of the gene operates at one pH, and another version operates at a very slightly different pH. And they think this might have given the monkey a slight advantage in...
But it was a badly chosen example because them monkeys didn't need the novelty at all. They were busy digesting leaves millions of years before. I mentioned that in my response.
Yes.
That was just a poor example, and it's not really a flaw in what Matzke had to say. He didn't realize this particular capuchin monkey. He didn't realize it. They did quite well without that, so there's no selective advantage
in this case. Gotcha. Okay, well, Dr. Berlinski, thank you very much. It's always fun to talk about these kinds of questions. I have a funny feeling that there's going to be more said about cladistics from our camp in response to Nick Matzke and in response to other critics of Darwin's Doubt. And thank you for your contributions on this. They really added to the discussion.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Well, I'm Casey Luskin with ID the Future. Stay tuned for more. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.